The prison population in the U.S. is well over 2 million people, and that means a lot of families are looking for ways to heal and stick together.
In the United States, 1 in 14 children has a parent who is or has been incarcerated.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll learn about a school-based program that helps students with an incarcerated family member. We'll also spend an academic minute with young people dealing with prison from the inside. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Nearly 3 million children in the U.S. have at least one parent in prison. Family incarceration has devastating effects on kids, from raising their level of poverty to a higher risk of school dropout and emotional stress. But the data fails to capture the stigma felt by youth who have a loved one who is in prison, let alone the sense of confusion and loss that so often comes in the wake of family incarceration. That problem was personal for Amy Friedman, an author and prison rights activist who is also the co-founder and executive director of the school-based program called POPS the Club. POPS stands for Pain of the Prison System. She's also the editor of the arts anthology published by POPS called Dreamcatchers. Along with her husband, Dennis Danziger, who is a high school teacher, she started POPS as a single club at Venice High School in Los Angeles. Today, there are 17 POPS clubs in 5 states. I spoke with Amy Friedman and asked how and why she started the POPS program.
From a very personal place, there's sort of two threads of this story. Thread number one was that many, many, many years ago, I was a newspaper columnist. I was visiting prisons to write about prison, and I ended up falling in love with and marrying a man who was in prison and raising his 2 young daughters. He and I were married for 7 years. We got divorced, but I have never divorced my daughters. And the experience of becoming a prisoner's wife and the mother of 2 young girls who had a parent in prison opened my eyes and my heart and my soul to what people who love people who are incarcerated experience. When my husband and I divorced some years later, I remarried, and my now husband is a teacher, and we both also are writers. I'd been a longtime writer and teacher of memoir and personal essay. And I began going with my husband into his classrooms to work with kids on personal essays and memoir. And we started to realize that there were so many kids in his classrooms who were experiencing the incarceration of a family member. We learned that because as you sort of dig into personal stories and you ask the right questions, and also because I was particularly sensitive to the experience, we learned about what they were going through. And then there's the startling statistic, which is that in the United States, 1 in 14 children has a parent who is or has been incarcerated. And so that means in pretty much every classroom, there are 1 or 2 or 10 kids going through this. But because it is such a stigmatized experience, we don't talk about it. They don't talk about it. And so people don't know about it. POPS grew out of both my husband and I deciding that we felt that these kids needed a place where they could feel heard and seen and safe, and where they had a protective, nurturing community around them. So that's the circle of the story.
Well, first of all, that is a startling statistic. And how at risk are these children? What are their risk factors other than just, you know, having one parent not around?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, they're myriad. They do rank high on ACE scales for depression, anxiety, school dropout, physical and mental illness, drug addiction.
And a quick interruption here. An ACE score is a tally of different types of abuse, neglect, and other adverse childhood experiences. A higher score indicates a higher risk for health problems later in life.
I don't want to further stigmatize them, but, you know, I think mostly we all are only as sick as our secrets. And because kids so often either feel because of experience of being stigmatized or because they've been told not to talk about this experience, that they need to keep it a secret. So it plays out for different kids in different ways, but it is very impactful. And having an opportunity to find out you're not alone and having an opportunity to talk about what you're going through, to recognize that other people are going through similar things, to be able to share that is very healing. We hear from a lot of kids that we work with that a lot of them will say, I was just on the verge of dropping out of school, or I've given up gangs, or I've given up violence, or I've given up drugs because now I have this community, these friends, this outlet. We do a lot of creating art and writing, and many of them find the outlet to be helpful and healing.
For students who are not able to keep this a secret, for where it's open, people know that they have a parent incarcerated, how are these students seen by their teachers and the school at large? Are they just seen as, oh, it's them?
You know, that's a really great question, and I'm reluctant to sort of cast aspersions on a large group of people, because I think that there are definitely teachers and principals and all kinds of people who are sensitive to the experience and try to provide support. But there are so few programs that exist to provide this population with support. And I think that one of two things happen. Either people never think about this as a particular burden someone might be carrying, and so it's ignored and therefore not treated, if you will. Or, yeah, there is some, you know, like, oh, he's going to end up like his dad. Or we work with kids who are impacted by incarceration in any way. So we also work with some kids who themselves have had run-ins with the law. And I think that people can sort of rise to their expectations. And if expectations are that they are somehow going to fail, that leads kids to fail, fulfilling those obligations or expectations. I'll tell you one little story that comes to mind. Is there's a young woman who's now graduated several years ago, and she's now about to go to law school. But when she first came to POPS, she was 14. She was a ninth grader, and she had just the previous year been arrested on her middle school campus for beating up another girl. And she was angry and lost and had been dealing with her own father's incarceration throughout her life. He was kind of in and out of jail throughout her life. And I think she just, her expectations for herself were minimal. And in POPS, she began writing, she began talking about the experience, she began learning from other people, and she decided she's going to law school to become a prosecutor because she feels that it's important for there to be prosecutors who understand the system and understand what people go through when they do experience incarceration and when they're impacted even peripherally. She's like my happy story. And there are a lot of them like that. But I just was talking to her recently, so she comes to mind.
Does the economic status of these families affect how much the children will be affected by this?
Well, yes. But, you know, I'll tell you another little story. I'm based in L.A. There's a very posh private school here that invited us many years ago, myself and some of the students, to come speak to their student body about the work we were doing. It was a community service presentation. And when we walked into the school, the librarian pulled me aside and she said, you know, I know 25 kids in this school who need this program, but the school director won't hear of it because they don't want the Association of Prison to taint the school's image. So in a way, while it's a different experience to be wealthy, to have, you know, to have money and comforts and experience incarceration at the same time, it can be almost more stigmatizing, I think. You know, you really learn, do not talk about it. We have a number of people who work with us as advisors and as editors for the books and who come from wealth and whose families were incarcerated, whose parents were incarcerated because of stock fraud and various other white-collar crimes, and they struggled and suffered, and they're, which is why they're connected with us. It's so meaningful to them.
How do you get students involved? Do they seek you out, or do you seek them out? Is a little bit of both?
There is a little bit of both. I'll tell you, one of the tenets, though, of POPS is that no one is sent. So the idea is that this is a place that you, as a student, you choose to come or not. So it's not a place where we, you know, counselors go, oh, I know Johnny has a dad in prison. He needs to go to this, because it really is only going to be helpful if it's by choice. It's hard to walk through the door the first time. One of the main criteria to make a POPS club is that there must be food. So sometimes kids walk through the door saying, oh, I'm just here because I'm hungry. And we never make anybody say why they're there. So you don't have to walk in the door and go, here's my story, this is why I'm here, and so on. So there are sometimes kids who will come to meetings for years before they are able to open up about their own experience, but they keep coming back. And then there are also, years ago, I got a call from a young woman who had just graduated high school, and she was in her first year of college, and she said, you know, I used to walk to the door of the POPS meeting every week, and I could never walk through the door. And now I'm in college, and I'm thinking, I want to bring POPS to my college campus. It's really important. So the responses are variable. Sometimes a teacher will maybe come with a student, will say, hey, let's go check this out. I've heard it's great. And that is helpful. It's hard to walk in by yourself. We also welcome kids to come with a friend. So it kind of runs the gamut. Well, and it's different in different schools, too. I think that there are some teachers, some principals who are more active about trying to encourage their students to come.
Well, that's another thing I wanted to ask is, you started at one school and you've been expanding. How does it expand? Do people come to you and say, this is a great idea, I want to do it?
Yeah. Well, originally I had a plan. I had picked out the schools where I wanted to start expanding and you know, best laid plans.
I had a plan that was past tense.
Right. Really what has happened is our expansion thus far has been serendipitous. We have grown into places where people find out about us and want to bring it to their school or to their community. We've had clubs started because, in several instances, we started at Venice High School, and we would have these visitors come. Kids would bring a friend from another school, and then they would reach out and say, hey, I want to bring this to my school. And I would always say, let's double team your principal. So we would double team the principal. And in some cases, it's been teacher-led. In some cases, it's been community-led. We are in a number of schools, many schools in Georgia. That has been in a partnership with Community and Schools in Georgia and a program called Safe Neighborhoods. And there's been a lot of partnerships that have helped us expand into places where people feel strong need. And we welcome people reaching out to find out how to bring it to their schools.
Still to come, our conversation with Amy Friedman continues with a look at how starting a POPS club can change the culture of a school. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Amy Friedman, the co-founder of the school-based program for students who have parents or other family members in prison. It's called POPS, Pain of the Prison System. We're talking about POPS, and I asked if they have gotten feedback on how the POPS program changes schools and students.
Yes. So for many years, that feedback was largely anecdotal and experiential. The last 2.5 years, we have a partnership with a public health team from two universities who created surveys and are helping us to collect and analyze data. So we're seeing what the impact on the kids themselves has been profound. On the schools, it's a little more anecdotal, but I can say that I think after about a year or two, one of the highlights of the program is it's not like people come into the room and just talk about prison and cry and feel bad. The club meetings themselves are vibrant and fun, and people, you know, and like I said, there's food, and people come out laughing, and they become kind of the cool club. So that really alters the perception. It has developed empathy in teachers and peers, empathy and curiosity. Because we publish a book every year of the work that is created by the students in the club, their poetry and their stories and their essays and their drawings and paintings and photographs, the books permeate the schools, so then kids read them. They're really popular reading material. And so people are learning these stories, that the books are all really intimate and powerful and beautiful. And so I would say empathy grows and the stigma diminishes. Joking around, we've had kids come to the door and go, I'm going to see if I can get my dad to just do a little bit of time so I can join Bob. So...
I never had that request at home. Okay.
Right.
It's affected everything else in our lives. How has COVID affected these clubs?
Oh, man. So COVID has affected these kids in the most profound ways. First of all, every school that we're in has been closed. And so all of our meetings for the last year or since last March have been virtual. It's not the same. You know, number one, no food. Number two, you know, virtual, we all know now the virtual world is not the same. Everybody misses getting hugs and that connection that happens when you can be in a room with someone. In addition, because prison visits are cut off and because COVID is running wild inside our institutions, it's a really scary, isolating, difficult time for these kids. So it's supremely challenging. And we carry on. It took a little while. We started right as soon as the schools closed. We moved to virtual meetings that for the first several months were, there were two meetings a week for every school everywhere. And now we've managed to, again, open up the individual school club meetings. So there are individual virtual meetings, but all of us, the kind of the refrain is, oh, we can't wait to go back to school.
I do want to talk a bit about the book, the new book that is out now called Dream Catchers, the club anthology of POPS. Artwork and poetry and photography. How much competition is there to get published in these books?
Oh, I love that question. You know, it's not a competition. This is what we accept. we accept all work that people create that they are willing to work on. So, you know, it's not like you just kind of throw something down on the page and send it. So everything that's in the book, kids have worked with a teaching artist or one of the editors or one of the volunteers in the school or their teacher and really committed to. But we try to publish everything we can, and the books just keep growing. And we also look for other outlets for their work because they are so smart. They have so much to teach us all. And I feel that it's very important that their voices and their visions be out in the world.
One thing that came to mind is that if a student is published in this book and people see it, everybody's going to know that they have a parent or some family member in prison.
So one of the things we allow, and this happens, is for if people want to publish under a pen name or anonymously, they're permitted to. And so you'll see in this collection, there are a few anonymous pieces. Quite often what happens is a student will, say, in ninth grade, publish a piece anonymously. And by the time that person is in their senior year, they're kind of more comfortable and they're ready to tell their story in their own name. Sometimes they feel protective of the person who they love, who's incarcerated, so they change their name because of that. But mostly, I think the pride they feel in their stories. Plus, I have to say this, that not every single piece is about prison. Every piece is about this is what it's like to be a teenager, because they're writing about all kinds of things in their lives. I have yet to hear from a single participant, and we have published now, I want to say, I think close to 900 young people, that they were disappointed or embarrassed, or they're very proud. One little story that I just love, there was a young man who graduated, and about 3 years after he graduated, he had written a piece that was in one of the anthologies, and he called me and my husband to ask us if we would meet him for a coffee. And we did. And in the course of the conversation, he started telling us that he had gone through a period in his life not very long before this when he had been homeless and living in his car. And his car had gotten broken into and everything was taken. And Dennis and I were preparing ourselves to hear him ask if he could borrow some money or if he could stay with us. Or we didn't know what he was preparing to ask. And he looked at us kind of shyly, and he said, what I wondered was, would it be possible for me to get another copy of the book that I was published in? Because that got stolen, too, and it was so important to me. That, to me, kind of summed it up.
That's amazing. It really is. So look ahead. Do you see a lot of growth potential still for this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When we started, the very first meeting in the very first club, first young woman who walked through the door was a 10th grader. Second young woman who walked through the door was a 10th grader. They looked at each other with such astonishment. It turned out they had been close friends since they were in kindergarten. They were now in 10th grade. And the one thing they had never told each other was it so happened they both had fathers in prison. And the look on their faces when they recognized what they shared was, I looked at Dennis and I said, okay, we are launching a 501c3 and we are bringing this to every school in the country. And honestly, it remains the dream to bring it everywhere. It's a relatively simple program. It is not without nuance. And so we've been careful not to just kind of say, sure, let's start right now, because we want to make sure that we have the infrastructure and ability to support the growth. But absolutely, we want to bring it to many, 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 many more schools.
Well, let me ask you this then. If someone is listening and says, hey, this would be great at the school I work in, what can they do?
They can. Please send an email to our website is popsclubs.org. And the info@popsclubs.org email, we'll get a response within a day or two. And we're happy to talk to anybody and everybody.
Amy Friedman is the co-founder and executive director of Pops the Club and the editor of the school's arts anthology, Dreamcatchers. Again, you can learn more on their website, popsclubs.org. Sometimes it's young people themselves and not family members who are inside the prison system. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Solitary confinement has wide-ranging effects on young adults. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Emily Restivo, associate professor of behavioral sciences at the New York Institute of Technology, examines these effects.
Two of the most pressing issues in corrections today are the number of inmates with mental health issues and the overuse of solitary confinement. In 2015, President Obama ordered the Department of Justice to review the effects of solitary confinement on inmates due to the potentially damaging effect of prolonged isolation. The department concluded that inmates may need to be segregated from the general population on occasion, but as a matter of policy, solitary confinement should rarely be used. However, solitary confinement continues to be applied to individuals under 18 years old who are waived into the adult system. Each year, over 200,000 children and youth are tried as adults across the country. Studies show that numerous adults with no history of mental health problems develop psychological symptoms in solitary confinement. For children and adolescents who are still developing and are more vulnerable to irreparable harm, the risks are magnified, particularly for youth with disabilities or histories of trauma and abuse. My recent research study shows that the number of days in solitary confinement significantly affects the number of mental health diagnoses. Further, it supports the argument to eliminate solitary confinement among all inmates due to the damaging psychological impact, but especially for juveniles waived into the adult system. Our results reinforce the need to hold youth in the juvenile justice system while awaiting trial. Additionally, our findings show that the mental health and safety of waived juveniles could be greatly improved if these individuals remain in youth facilities until the age of 21 and are withheld from the unnecessary use of solitary confinement for disciplinary reasons.
That was Emily Restivo of the New York Institute of Technology. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.